The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
Good morning, everyone. So this weekend we have been in a vigil for the Buddha's enlightenment, which we do each year, that both celebrates, honors, and walks in the footsteps of the Buddha's enlightenment. And it's interesting in Buddhism, I find it interesting, that the founder of this tradition is clearly an important figure, our original teacher, and yet does not hold the kind of primacy that you might think of, that might find in other traditions. But his teachings do. His teachings are what are held up and put forth and engaged in every day. And I think that is as he would have wanted it. It is as he taught. And in celebrating the Buddha's enlightenment, and to think of, I spoke a little bit about this on Friday night, but to think about this person, this human being, just in this little patch of earth, northern India, living his own life, setting out on his own journey, and coming to an experience that we call enlightenment. That in Buddhism, because that word is used in the West in all kinds of ways, it has a very particular meaning in Buddhism, what it refers to, what he experienced, what we can practice and experience. And that experience was powerful enough, so powerful, that it set into motion such that here we are this morning, an experience. Now, of course, we're very fortunate, as were the very first students of the Buddha, that he was, by all signs, a very intelligent person, very articulate, that he had learned how to lead, because that was supposed to be his job before he left home. In other words, he didn't just have an experience, but he had certain skills that he was able to bring forth and, in a sense, put it in the employment of the Dharma so that he could communicate it. And not just communicate it in words, but help to establish, build a way of practicing, because he just went his way, right? And this is clear through the sutras, through his own words. He was figuring things out as he went, because there was no precedent. There was nobody he could follow. But then he began to establish a path that people could follow. He could have said, well, I did it my way. You just have to do it your way. Goodbye. Right? And so to think about, you know, we talk about causes and conditions, that the karmic actions, the conditions that were present at that time, at that very particular time, at that moment, with that person that was able to set into motion all of this. And that what if he lived a short life? He lived a long life, right? That gave him the chance to develop those teachings, to teach in 100,000 different settings to different people, different circumstances, over time, to establish practicing communities. Right? He was able to do that because he lived a long life. So think about all these just very particular factors that we might not think about much, but actually played very strongly into what he was able to do for our benefit. And so when we, you know, hold up and sort of vigil, spend a weekend in vigil on a continuous practice, basically, in the path of the Buddha's enlightenment, we're also really including the path, the three treasures, all of the teachings, everything that he taught. The path, he said over and over again, is the Eightfold Path, right view, right thought, right speech, action, livelihood, effort, meditation, concentration. When it came into China, when Buddhism came to China, the sense of the Tao, a road, a path that, in which you convey yourself, you move yourself along. And in a more sort of ultimate sense, a way that is not just a way of practice and a way of being, but something much broader, much more spacious, much more fundamental. So what is it to walk a true path? What is true Dharma, right? We hear that phrase, true Dharma. May the true Dharma continue. There is no truth that resides somewhere, right? In some text, in some place, in some mind. Truth is not a thing. That's important to appreciate. And so what is true Dharma? A true path. We want to make sure that we're on a true path, right? We don't want to be wasting our time. We don't want to be engaging ourselves wholeheartedly in something that isn't worthy of that. In the Eightfold Path, right speech, understanding, and so on refers to right as in accord with the Dharma. But to be in accord with the Dharma is to be in accord with reality. So right speech is to speak in a way that is in accord with reality. The reality of being a human being. The reality of human interactions and relationships. The power of speech to create karma. To speak in a way that is in accord with the path of the Dharma. So that the speech that we're using, the livelihood, the effort, and so on, are not just right in some sort of ultimate, you know, sense theoretically out there, but is right in the sense that it is in alignment with what I want to be doing in my life as a practitioner, what you want to be doing. So we might think of that a true path is one that brings us to the place that we are seeking. What is it that we are seeking? That's why there's so much emphasis on this in Buddhism. When we talk about aspiration, right intention, in a sense, that's presupposing that we already have some sense of what we're seeking. And that aspiration is giving voice to that, helping to clarify that. So if we think of a path as one that brings me to the place that I am seeking, I haven't been there, I haven't experienced that, I haven't realized that, I have faith. As a practitioner of the Dharma, I see that other people, hundreds, thousands of people, over the centuries, have walked this path and have found their way to this place that they spoke of. You know, as I often say, I think of them, you know, the Buddha and teachers of old as reporters. You know, they went out into the field that's sitting on your cushion. They traveled very deeply. They encountered something beyond ideas and concepts, and then they came back and reported. And their report is astonishingly similar, even across traditions. When you look at the mystics, those who had deeper, direct experience into the nature of things, they use different language. In a theistic religion, they're going to language it around God. They're going to see it in relationship to God, naturally. In Buddhism, it's a little different. So a true path is one by which we bring ourselves, and in the Bodhisattva path, others, to be free from samsara. That's what makes it true. And I've often thought that in order to be a true path, it has to be universal, right? It has to be true all the time, right? It can't be true in Ulster County, but not in Dutchess, right? That's not going to work. Or it's true in New York, but sorry, New Jersey. It doesn't work there, right? Or it works today, but it doesn't work, you know, 10 years from now. Didn't work 100 years in the past. In other words, that's not universal. It has to be universal. True in all times, in all situations, in all places. But being universal, it also has to be immediately imminent now. Because if it's universal in some vague, atmospheric, cosmic sense, but it's not here, then it's of no use to me. It has to be universal in the sense of it being timeless, but it has to be completely in accord in this time, here, now. And that is changing every moment. So it has to have both of those qualities. It has to be something I can do, right? If it was true Dharma, but not for you, sorry. Pointless. So it has to be universal and completely appropriate to this time and space and something I can actually do. And then I need to do it. Those factors, I think, are in my own thinking about it, reflecting on it. You know, how do we know if something is worthy of our commitment? In the teaching of the ox herding pictures downstairs, you see these portraits in the verses, which is an ancient way of just describing the path. In searching for the ox here is the true self. It's your true nature. The first of those is, in the pasture of the world, I endlessly push aside the tall grasses in search of the true self, following unnamed rivers lost upon the interpenetrating paths of distant mountains. My strength failing, my vitality exhausted, I cannot find the ox. I only hear the locusts chirping through the forest at night. I've told the story of how years ago we had a Japanese priest come here with his son, who was about 18, who did not seem particularly interested in Buddhism, which his father wanted to do something about. And so they were traveling and they came here and they were, you know, father was dressed in his priest robes and his son was dressed in shorts and a t-shirt. And we were standing, he was admiring those portraits by Chikihara Sensei. And he was standing in front of the first one. And then he pointed to the blank piece of wall to the left and he said, "My son, here." His son was standing right there. And I thought, yeah, that's going to be tough. In the pasture of the world, I endlessly push aside the tall grasses in search of the true self. Yunmen, Master Yunmen, said, "The world is vast and wide. Why do you put on your robe at the sound of the bell? Everything is impermanent, fleeting, unpredictable. Every day there are tasks to do, meals to prepare, clean up, jobs to be done, children to raise. Why do you sit on your diamond seat every day? Why are you gathered here today in this hall of awakening?" The Buddha lived within a world of dreams. We all do. His were, by all accounts, good dreams. He had pretty much all that anybody could want. A loving family, friends, wealth, service to his community, position, a wife, child. That was his pasture, his home. But it also, by his own words, was a seat of his unrest. You know, I think of how, you know, he was a kid. He was a little boy. He played with his friends. He ran around, got into mischief, I'm sure. Did his studies. Was pampered, as he himself said. And then he grew up. When did that unrest arrive? When did that first start showing up for him? Some people seem to be born with a stirring. For other people, it comes later. Not necessarily precipitated by anything. For some people, it is precipitated by something. Something significant in their lives that sets them to wondering, questioning. So he lived in a place of plenty, but as he grew older, it was less and less satisfying. And in a sense, he was not tempted by that. Less and less. It was not yet his Buddha field. In the Vimalakirti Sutra, Vimalakirti speaks about the Buddha field, which is described as a field of living beings in which a bodhisattva embraces that field to the same extent that they help develop living beings. And so on the bodhisattva path, think of how we're each in a Buddha field as a practitioner. And in that field, we embrace it. And that field includes everything, right? Everything within our lives is our Buddha field. And the purpose of that field is to help develop living beings. And so we embrace that field. We are intimate with it. We are living within it to the extent that we are helping to develop living beings. So it seems to me that for the Buddha, it wasn't yet a Buddha field for him. It was rather a place of tall grasses. Grass is often used as a way of describing delusion, things that impede, distract, obstruct. But in his pasture, he had loving friends and family and meaningful work and wealth and so on. Those themselves are not distracting. They're not obstructions, impediments. But for when we lose ourselves, we get lost to ourselves, we get lost to our purpose, our vows, then they seem to be that. And so the Buddha said, from the sutra I talked about on, or quoted from on Friday, he says, before my awakening, when I was an unawakened bodhisattva, he basically said, I realized that I was subject to life and death, to aging and illness, to sorrow, that I was subject, he was subject to everything that everybody can experience. And he recognized that he kept going back to those very things to try and find his fulfillment, to find the place of his seeking. And he began to question that. He said, the thought occurred to me, why do I keep doing that? Shantideva said, we want to be free of suffering, but we go back to the causes of our suffering. It's the same point. But he began to notice that. He noticed that he was doing that. Everybody doesn't. That's a shift. That's kind of a tear in the fabric, right? A light coming through. And not that only did he notice it, because lots of people notice it and just carry on. He noticed it and began to question, the thought occurred to me, why? Why do I do this? That's pivotal. That's Buddhism. Why? And then he began to think, well, wait a minute, what if I am subject to all these things? But what if I didn't go back, keep going back, recognize that I keep doing the same thing, what if I did something different? That too is pivotal. Because he could spend the rest of his time, rest of his life, writing philosophical treatises on why he keeps going back. And as he keeps going back, but he didn't. He began to wonder, well, what if I don't do that? Because he wanted something else. What if I meet that which suffers, which ages, which is sorrowful? Who is it? Is that necessary? Is that just what life is? Or is there another way? And so then he went forth from the home life into homelessness. And he says in that passage, so at a later time, while still young, he's in his 20s, this is all in the same sutra. So he's recounting this sort of process that he went through. And then he recognizes what he's doing. He recognizes the situation that he's in. He's subject to all these things. He recognizes he keeps going back. And then he begins to think, well, what if I didn't? And then he says, at a later time, which means he didn't just impulsively do something. He reflected. He thought about it. He entered into it carefully. And then in the Oxfordian picture, it says, following unnamed rivers lost upon the interpenetrating paths of distant mountains. He walked out of the only place he'd ever known, his place of security, his place of the future, his place of a reasonable amount of comfort, certainty. He went seeking. He studied with two different teachers, both of whom had communities and were, I don't know how he did his research, right? How did they do that back then? Because he went to these specific teachers. There were lots of teachers teaching at that time, but he went to these specific teachers. So he must have had conversations, talked to people, right? Other wanderers, other seekers. He chose these two particular teachers who had communities, and they took him in as a student. And you can imagine getting this person as a student, right? That would be a little bit of a plum, a feather in your cap, because obviously, even if he's wearing, you know, whatever he was wearing, he wasn't wearing his finery. The moment he opens his mouth, you know, right, that he's been groomed for something. He has a bearing. He has a dignity. And so they took him in and they taught him meditation. They taught him, this is the way you meditate in order to achieve liberation. And he did that, and it seems that he excelled at it, such that in both of those cases, the teacher came to a point, the Buddha came to the teacher and said, this is what I've experienced under your teaching, following your practice. And the first teacher said, the Dharma I know is the Dharma you now know. The Dharma you know is the Dharma I know. As I am, so are you. As you are, so am I. Come, friend, let us lead this community together. So you think about it, here's a relative newcomer who's come in within a pre-existing community, enters in, practices, accomplishes, and is invited to co-lead. So that would seem like a resolution to the search. In a sense, he's found a new community, a new kind of security, a future, a place, a position. And he says, but in this way, my teacher placed me, his pupil, on the same level with himself and paid me great honor. But the thought occurred to me, the Dharma, this Dharma that he taught me, that I have realized, does not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to stilling, to direct knowledge, to awaken. It has not freed me, but only to reappearance in the dimension of nothingness. So the teaching that he had received, the meditation, was bringing into a state that he calls the dimension of nothingness. And he said, so dissatisfied with this Dharma, I left. So again, think of that clarity of his aspiration. He was seeking something. He hadn't experienced it. He didn't know what it was, but he had a sense of what he was seeking, such that he had a sense that he would know. And in this experience, he realized, I have not experienced that because I know that I am not yet liberated. He could see that. And then after doing that again with another teacher, then he began doing ascetic practices. Right? Another prevalent practice at that time with a small community. And he details how he did that. And he said, and it was kind of amazing because he's sort of bringing us into his thought process. He says, so I thought, as he's practicing with these ascetics, and there are various forms of asceticism, certainly at that time still prevalent in India. And so he's sort of, I guess, sort of surveying the possible practices he could take up. And he said, so I thought, suppose that I, clenching my teeth and pressing my tongue against the roof of my mouth, were to beat down, constrain, and crush my mind with my awareness. In other words, he's recognizing that his mind, maybe this sounds familiar, right? Seems to be a problem. It's distracted, it's wild, it's restless, it's painful, it's chaotic, it's confined. So he did what we do in our own ways at times, think, well, maybe it's a solution, I'll just stop it. What if I beat it down, constrain it, crush this mind? He's guiding himself. He's trying to figure it out. He's trying to find his way. He's guiding himself based on what he's experienced so far. Because remember, he's already sort of mastered these other forms of meditation. So he's bringing that to it. And he's trying to, based on what else is available to him, he's trying these other practices. So he tries that for a while. And he didn't find that helpful. And he goes into a lot of detail. And then he says, so then I thought, well, suppose I were to become absorbed in the trance of non-breathing. Right? If you're trying to bring everything to complete cessation and you keep breathing, and that keeps like, is a movement, is a distraction, is like, well, what if that stopped? And so he says, so I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths in my nose and mouth. And as I did so, there was a loud roaring of winds coming out of my ear holes. Extreme forces sliced through my head, just as if a strong person were slicing my head open with a sharp sword. Extreme pains arose in my head. He's trying to find a way, right? And so he abandons that. And he says, well, suppose I were only to take a little bit of food at a time, only a handful at a time, bean soup, lentil soup, pea soup. So I only took a little. My body became extremely emaciated. When we were in India, there's a cave where there's a life-size, larger than life-size, carving a statue of the Buddha at this point. And it's in a cave, so you have to go in, and it's really startling. Because as he says, you know, he could press the inside of his belly button and touch his spine. He came very close to the point of death. And then he said, so then I thought, whatever contemplative in the past has felt painful, racking, piercing feelings due to their striving, this that I am experiencing now is the utmost. No one could experience anything greater than this and live. The verse says, my strength failing, my vitality exhausted, I cannot find the bull. So as I said on Friday night, because the Buddha did this, we don't have to. Right? And then he said, I thought. So again, he keeps engaging. He keeps engaging. He's not just doing this practice and saying, okay, this is what I'm doing no matter what. He keeps examining it while he's doing it. And at each point, he realizes, okay, this is not it. This is not bringing me closer to liberation. He abandons it and tries something else. And then he says, so now I thought, I recall once when I was young and the community was out working in the fields and I was sitting in the cool shade of rose apple tree and secluded and quiet, I entered and remained in the first level of meditation, which came to be part of his teaching. Could that be the path to awakening? So he remembered a time where very innocently, without even trying, he just fell into a very simple but deep state of meditation, what's considered sort of an initial entry into meditation. And then he asked himself, could that be the path? Remember, all of this is coming up to this point. And then he says, and then following on that memory came the realization, the conviction, that is the path. He realized that has to be it. And then he asks, so why am I afraid of that pleasure that has nothing to do with sensuality, nothing to do with unskillful mental qualities? So he knows about all kinds of pleasures that comes from just following sense desires, unskillful mental, you know, activities, behavior, thoughts. And remember, he's just left a period of years of ascetic practice where you don't get no pleasure. Right? None. And now he remembers this very innocent moment, and it's like he realizes that's the path. And then he realizes that it felt good, that in that moment he remembers there was a kind of rapturous feeling, a peaceful feeling, a blissful feeling. It was pleasurable. And he's basically saying, don't be afraid of that. That this path of awakening includes, incorporates, in a sense requires these experiences that are actually pleasurable, but of a different sort. And so then he said, but that pleasure is not easy to achieve with a body so extremely emaciated. So suppose I were to take some food. So then he does. And his partners, his fellow ascetics, when they saw, he says, when they saw me taking some solid food, they were disgusted and left me, thinking, Gautama, the contemplative, is living luxuriously. He has abandoned his exertion and is backsliding into abundance. He's got a bowl of rice porridge, right? But to them, and so here he is, you know, he sort of had opportunities to join each of these communities, right? And he recognized community is important. It becomes one of the three treasures. He spends the whole of his life building a community. And yet he walks away from each of those communities and is vilified for it, right? Because he is clear about something. And he's fed by Sujata, who was a woman who lived in the area. And she had she had wanted to be married and have a child. She wanted a family. And so she used to go and make offerings of food in the forest at the base of a tree, appealing to the tree spirits. So one day she goes to make because she does get married and have a child. She's very happy about that. So she keeps going to make these offerings as a way of continuing to express her gratitude. And as she goes to that tree, there's the Buddha sitting, completely emaciated, at this very moment. She thinks he's a tree spirit who's been embodied, so she gives him the bowl, right? She's always just placed it down there, but now there's actually a tree spirit there. She's delighted. So she gives him the bowl, and he takes it, and he eats it. When we went to India years ago, there's a stupa built in honor of Sujata for feeding the Buddha. And it's very near Bodh Gaya, so that's where then he went wandering, having a little bit of sustenance, went wandering, found a place that was conducive to his striving, as he said, and he sat down. And then Mara comes, right? And Mara says, oh, you're so thin and pale, and you're in death's presence, you're very close to death. There are 1,000 ways pledged to death. There are 1,000 ways to die. But life still holds one part of you. You still have some life. Sir, life is the better way. You can gain merit if you live. Come, live the holy life and pour libations on the holy fires. That's a world of merit gain. What can you do by struggling now? The path of struggling, too, is rough and difficult. It's hard to bear. Come with me. The Buddha is tempted. In the poem I offered to the Buddha, amidst a sea of temptations, the Buddha gave the earth as his witness. And the Buddha, in response to Mara, said, none but the brave will conquer this to gain bliss by the victory. Better I die in battle now than choose to live on in defeat. Remember, he was trained as a warrior. So it's kind of natural that he would think in this way, a spiritual battle. I sally forth to fight that I may not be driven forth from my post, from my seat, from my commitment, my conviction. For I have faith and energy, and I have wisdom too. He has these important qualities. I have faith. I will say that. His life is a testimony to his faith and his energy. And his wisdom. I sally forth that I may not be driven from my post. And then it said that at the dawning of the morning star, the head crown broke wide. There's a koan that students sit with that says, sitting in absolute silence, mind, source, unmoved, filled like still water. A star at dawn has opened the gate of the head's crown. Beginningless self-nature has been awakened. You know, I said on Friday that it's easy to, I mean, I know when I came into Buddhism, Buddhist practice, you know, I was very drawn to the teachings, to the practice of meditation. Ultimately, when I came here, to my teacher, the Buddha was like, okay. He was like this idea of something, somebody that lived a long time ago, you know, but I've got this living teacher right here in front of me. You know, it was very abstract, very distant. It wasn't really alive or present for me. But I could see in my teacher that he had a very alive relationship, experience with the Buddha, with the ancestors, that was very real. Right? I wondered about that. And so in that way, distance by time and, you know, story and myth and so on, it can be very abstract. And that's why I think it's nice to just sort of, you know, go into the reality of this, this person, this time, these people, these experiences. And to think of the reality of that. I mean, you know, we can live in here, vacillate over whether we want to get out of bed and do Zazen or, you know. When COVID hit and everything went online, we thought, will anybody ever want to come back here on a Sunday morning? Be so troubled? And I think these examples are important. They help us to hold, you know, the things that we may feel like impediments and obstacles in a broader, more relative, maybe a better way to look at them, to sort of consider, you know, the faith, the energy, the wisdom, the fortitude, the patience. Because again, remember, he didn't know how it was going to play out. It said that after he ate the porridge from Sujata, he took the bowl and he went down to the river and he set it into the current and said, if I am to become a Buddha today, this bowl will flow upstream. And it did. And then it sank. That's a good story. Right? You can try that on your own. Yeah. But he didn't know. Right? To think of that, having a sense that is so strong, that would not just, I mean, in a sense, leaving home, I don't know if that was easy, but it certainly didn't get easier. And at any point, ostensibly, he could just go back home and say, yeah, you know, I tried that. Didn't quite work out. This looks pretty good. I can make this work. You taught the path and showed all the world. All the world. All the world. So that we could see. And so I think now the Buddha was in his Buddha field. What is that? Vimalakirti said, in a Buddha field, the Buddha introduces living beings to Buddha wisdom, helps increase their spiritual faculties, great aspiration, high resolve, generosity, morality, patience, effort, meditation. All those who live by love, compassion, joy, and equanimity are born into the Buddha field of Shakyamuni, Vimalakirti's teaching. All those who live by what we call the four measurables, who actually live by that. So it's important to appreciate how important that practice is, that meditation. Very important in Buddhism. By practicing that, we are living by that. We're born into the Buddha field of Shakyamuni, this formless field of benefaction. In the dedication this morning, the liturgy is chanted, the pure Dharmakaya neither appears nor disappears. That's what the Buddha realized, the pure Dharmakaya, self-nature, true nature, your original face, the nature that is aging-less, illness-less, deathless, sorrow-less. That from the beginning, you are like this, I am like this, everyone is like this. And then the liturgist chanted, the vows of compassion seem to come and go. They seem to come and go. Sometimes they're the present, sometimes they're not. Sometimes we're patient, sometimes we're not. Sometimes we feel a great feeling of love or caring, and sometimes we don't. They seem to come and go. They seem to come and go. Are we trying to create something that exists outside of ourselves that we don't actually possess, get some of that? Or are we actually awakening something that we have in full, complete? But because they seem to come and go, we come together and practice a vigil in the footsteps of the Buddha. We come here on this Sunday morning. We sit on our cushion at home. We bring forth our intentions. We chant a sutra. We establish an aspiration and practice it. Why? Each of you answer that. And let that be a living question, a living answer. It's not answered once. It can be answered in our mind, but it's answered in what we do. It's answered in how we live our lives. That's why this is a practice, right? How fortunate we are. So thank you for this vigil, for those of you who are with us. This is how minds are changed. This is how compassion is brought forth. It's a living thing.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.